The arrest was made 6 hours after the bomb blast, and even the English press was fulsome in its praise of the efficiency of the police investigation. Every front page across the nation carried photographs of Colonel Lothar de la Rey. 6 weeks later, in the Johannesburg Supreme Court, Jacobus Stander pleaded guilty to the charge of murder and was sentenced to death. 2 weeks later, his appeal was denied by the appellate division in Bloemfontein, and sentence of death was confirmed. Lothar de la Rey's promotion to brigadier was announced within days of the appellate division's decision. Raleigh Tabaka arrived in Cape Town while the Stander trial was still in progress. He came back the way he had left, as a crewman on a Liberian-registered tramp steamer. His papers, although issued in the name of Goodwill Mlachazini, were genuine, and he passed quickly through customs and immigration, and with his bag over his shoulder, walked up the foreshore to the main Cape Town railway station. When he reached the Witwatersrand the following evening, he caught the bus out to Drake's farm and went to the cottage where Victoria Gama was staying. Vicky opened the door, and she had the child by the hand. There was the smell of cooking from the little kitchenette at the back. She started violently as she saw him. "Raleigh, come in quickly!" And she drew him into the cottage and bolted the door. "You shouldn't have come here. You know that I am banned. They watch this place," she told him, as she went quickly to the windows and drew the curtains. Then she came back to where he stood in the centre of the room and studied him. "Oh, you have changed," she said softly. "You are a man now." The training and the discipline of the camps had left their mark. He stood straight and alert, and he seemed to exude an intensity and a force that reminded her of Moses Gama. "He has become one of the lions," she thought. And she asked, "Why have you come here, Raleigh, and how can I help you?" "I have come to free Moses Gama from the prison of the Boers, and I will tell you how you can help me." Victoria gave a little cry of joy and clutched the child closer to her. "Tell me what to do," she pleaded. He would not stay to eat the evening meal with Victoria, would not even sit down on one of the cheap deal chairs. "When is your next visit to Moses?" he asked in a low but powerful voice. "In 8 days' time," Victoria told him, and he nodded. "Yes, I knew it was soon. That was part of our planning. Now here is what you must do." When the prison launch ran out from Cape Town Harbour, carrying Victoria and the child to exercise their 6 monthly visiting rights, Raleigh Tabaka was on the deck of one of the crayfish trawlers that was moored alongside the repair wharf in the outer harbour. Raleigh was dressed like one of the trawlermen, in a blue jersey, yellow plastic overalls and sea boots. He pretended to be working on the pile of crayfish pots on the foredeck, but he studied the ferry as it passed close alongside, before it made the turn out through the entrance to the breakwater. He made out Victoria's regal figure in the stern. She was wearing her caftan in yellow, green and black, the colours of the ANC, which always infuriated the jailers. When the ferry had cleared the harbour and was set on course towards the low whaleback profile of Robben Island, far out in the bay, Raleigh walked back along the deck of the 80-foot trawler to the wheelhouse. The skipper of the trawler was a burly coloured man, dressed like Raleigh, in jersey and waterproofs. Raleigh had met his son at the Lord Kitchener Hotel in London, an activist who had taken part in the Lunga uprising and had fled the country immediately afterwards. "Thank you, comrade," Raleigh said, and the skipper came to the door of the wheelhouse and took the black pipe from between his even white teeth. "Did you find out what you wanted?" "Yes, comrade. When will you need me for the next part?" "Within 10 days, Raleigh replied. "You must give me at least 24 hours warning. I have to get a permit from the fisheries department to work in the bay." Raleigh nodded. "I have planned for that." He turned his head to look forward towards the trawler's bows. "Is your boat strong enough?" he asked. "You let me worry about that," the skipper chuckled. "A boat that can live in the South Atlantic winter gales is strong enough for anything." He handed Raleigh the small canvas airline bag that contained his street clothes. We will meet again soon, then, my friend. You can be sure of that, comrade, Raleigh said quietly, and went up the gangplank onto the wharf. Raleigh changed out of his trawlerman's gear in the public toilet near the harbour gates, and then went across to the car park behind the customs house. Ram Sammy's old Toyota was parked up against the fence, and Raleigh climbed into the back seat. Sammy Ram Sammy looked up from the copy of the Cape Times he was reading. He was a good-looking young Hindu lawyer who specialised in political cases. For the previous 4 years, he had represented Vicky Garma in her never-ending legal battle with authority, and he had accompanied her from the Transvaal on this visit to her husband. "Did you get what you wanted?" he asked, and Raleigh grunted non-committally. "I don't want to know what this is all about," Sammy Ram Sammy said. And Raleigh smiled coldly. "Oh, don't worry, comrade. You will not be burdened with that knowledge." They did not speak again. Not for the next 4 hours, while they waited for Vicky to return from the island. She came at last, tall and stately, in her brilliant caftan and turban, the child beside her, and the coloured stevedores working on the dock recognised her and cheered her as she passed. She came to the Toyota and climbed into the front seat with the child on her lap. "He is on another hunger strike," she said. "He has lost so much weight, he looks like a skeleton." "That'll make our work a lot easier," said Sammy Ram Sammy, and started the Toyota. At 9 o'clock the next morning, Ram Sammy presented an urgent application to the Supreme Court for an order that a private physician be allowed access to the prisoner Moses Garma, and as grounds to support his application, he presented the sworn affidavits of Victoria Dinizulu Garma and the local representative of the International Red Cross as to the deterioration in the prisoner's physical and mental condition. The judge in chambers issued an order calling on the Minister of Justice to show cause within 24 hours why the access order should not be granted. The State Attorney General opposed the application strenuously, but after listening to Mr. Samuel Ramsamy's submission, the judge granted the order. The physician named in the order was Dr. Chetty Abrahamji, the same man who had delivered Tara Courtney's son. He was a consulting physician at Groote Schuur Hospital. In company with the government district physician, Dr. Abrahamji made the ferry trip out to Robben Island, where for 3 hours he examined the prisoner in the prison clinic. At the end of the examination, he told the state doctor, "I don't like this at all. The patient is very much underweight, complaining of indigestion and chronic constipation. I don't have to spell out what those presentations suggest." "Now, these symptoms have been caused by the fact that the prisoner has been on a hunger strike. In fact, I've been considering attempting to force feed." "No, doctor," Abrahamji interrupted him. "I see the symptoms as much more significant. I'm ordering a CAT scan." "But there are no facilities available for a CAT scan on the island." "Then he will have to be moved to Groote Schuur for the examination." Once again, the State Attorney General opposed the order for the prisoner to be moved from Robben Island to Groote Schuur Hospital. But the judge was influenced by Dr. Abrahamji's written report and impressed by his verbal evidence, and once again granted the order. Moses Garma was brought to the mainland amid the strictest conditions of secrecy and security. No previous warning of the move was given to any person outside those directly involved, to prevent the organisation of any form of demonstration by liberal political bodies, and to frustrate the intense desire of the press to obtain a photograph of this patriarch of black aspirations. It was necessary, however, to give Dr. Abrahamji 24 hours advance notice to enable him to reserve the use of the test equipment at the hospital, and the police moved into the area of the hospital the evening before the transfer. They cleared the corridors and rooms through which the prisoner would move of all but his central hospital staff and searched them for explosives or any indication of illegal preparations. From the public telephone booth in the main hospital administration block, Dr. Abrahamji rang Raleigh Tabaka at Molly Broadhurst's house in Pinelands. "I am expecting company at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon," he said simply. "Your guest must not leave you until after nightfall," Raleigh replied. "That can be arranged," Abraham G. agreed, and hung up. The prison ferry came in through the harbour entrance at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The dead lights of the cabin portholes were closed, and there were armed prison warders on deck, fore and aft, and their vigilance was apparent, even from where Raleigh was working on the foredeck of the trawler. The ferry sailed across the harbour to A berth, its usual mooring. There was an armoured prison van waiting on the dock, with 4 motorcycle police in uniform and a grey police Land Rover. Through the riot screens on the cab of the Land Rover, Raleigh could make out the shape of helmets and the short, thick barrels of automatic shotguns held at port arms. As the ferry touched the wharf, the prison van reversed up and the rear doors swung open. The armed warders, seated on the padded benches in the body of the truck, jumped down to meet the prisoner. Raleigh had just a glimpse of a tall, gaunt figure in plain prison khaki uniform as he was hustled up the gangplank and into the waiting van. But even across the width of the harbour basin, he could see that Moses Garmer's hair was now pure silvery white, and that he was manacled at the wrists, and that heavy leg irons hampered his gait. The doors of the van slammed shut. The motorcycle escort closed in formation around it, and the Land Rover followed closely behind it as it sped away towards the main dock gates. Raleigh left the trawler, and Molly Broadhurst was waiting for him beyond the main gates. They drove up the lower slopes of Table Mountain to where the hospital stood, a massive complex of white walls and red clay tiles below the stone pines and open meadows of Rhodes Estate, and the tall grey rock buttresses of the mountain itself. Raleigh made a careful note of the time required for the journey from the docks to the hospital. They drove slowly up the busy road to the main entrance of the hospital. The police Land Rover, motorcycles and armoured van were lined up in the public car park beyond the entrance to the outpatient section. The warders had doffed their riot helmets and were standing around the vehicles in relaxed attitudes. "How will Abraham G. keep him there until dark?" Molly wanted to know. "I did not ask," Raleigh replied. "I expect he will keep on demanding further tests, or will deliberately sabotage the machinery. I don't know." Raleigh turned the car in a circle in front of the main entrance, and they drove back down the hill. "You are sure there is no other way to leave the hospital grounds?" Raleigh asked. "Quite sure," Molly replied. "The van must pass here. Drop me at the bus stop. It'll be a long wait, and at least I'll have a bench to sit on." Raleigh pulled into the curb. "You have the number of the telephone on the dock and coins?" she nodded. "Where is your nearest telephone from here?" he insisted. "I've checked it all carefully. There's a public phone booth at the corner," she pointed. "It'll take 2 minutes for me to reach it, and if it is out of order or occupied, there is another telephone in the cafe across the street. I've already made friends with the proprietor." Raleigh left her at the bus stop and drove back to the centre of town. He left Molly's car in the side street they had agreed upon, so that it would not be found at the docks or anywhere in the vicinity, and he walked back down the Herengracht, showing his seaman's papers at the gate. The skipper of the trawler was in the wheelhouse, and he handed Raleigh a mug of heavily sweetened coffee, which he sipped as they went over the final arrangements. "Are my men ready?" Raleigh asked as he stood up, and the skipper shrugged. "That's your business, not mine." They were in the bottom of the trawler's deep hold, where the heat in the unventilated space was oppressive. Robert and Changi were stripped to vests and jogging shorts. They jumped up as Raleigh came down the ladder. "So far it goes well," Raleigh assured them. They were old companions from the PAC Poco days, and Changi had been at Sharpville on the terrible day that Amelia died. "Are you ready?" Raleigh asked him. "We can check," Changi suggested. "Once more will not hurt us." The inflatable Zodiac boat that stood on the floor of the hold was the 17-foot-6-inch model that could carry 10 adults with ease. The 50-horsepower Evinrude outboard motor could push it at 30 knots. The cover of the engine had been painted matte black. The rig had been stolen by Robert and Changi, working together from the yard of a boat dealer 2 days before, and could not be traced back to any of them. "The engine," Raleigh demanded. "Robert has checked and serviced it." "I even changed the gearbox oil," Robert agreed. "She runs beautifully." "Tanks? Both full," Robert said. "We have a range of 100 miles or better." "Wetsuits?" "Check," Changi said. "And thermal blankets for the leader." "Tools?" Raleigh asked. And Changi opened the padded flotation bag and laid out the tools on the deck, checking each as Raleigh called them from his list. "Good," Raleigh agreed at last. "You can rest now. Nothing more to do." Raleigh climbed up out of the hold. It was still too early. He glanced at his wristwatch. Not yet 4 o'clock. But he left the trawler and went down the dock to the public telephone booth at the end. He telephoned directory inquiries and asked for a fictitious number in Johannesburg, just to make certain the line was in order. Then he sat on the edge of the wharf, with his legs dangling, and watched the seagulls squabbling over the offal and refuse that floated on the harbour waters. It was fully dark by 7:40, but it was another 20 minutes before the telephone in the booth rang, and Raleigh jumped up. "They're on their way!" Molly's voice was soft and muffled. "Thank you, comrade," Raleigh said. "Go home now." He hurried back down the wharf, and the trawler skipper had seen him coming. As Raleigh jumped down onto the dock, the two deckhands threw off the lines. The big caterpillar motor blustered, and the trawler surged away from the dock and headed out through the entrance. Raleigh swarmed down into the hold where Robert and Changi were already in their wetsuits. They had Raleigh's suit laid out for him, and they helped him into it. "Ready?" one of the deckhands called down from above. "Send it down," Raleigh shouted back, and they watched the arm of the derrick swing out over the hold, silhouetted against the stars, and the line came down from the boom. The three of them worked swiftly, hooking the Zodiac on. But before they had finished, the beat of the trawler's engine died away, and the motion of the hull in the water changed as the vessel's way died, and she began to drift. Raleigh led them up the ladder onto the deck. The night was moonless, but the stars were bright and clear. The light breeze was from the southeast, so there was unlikely to be a change in this fair weather. All the trawler's navigational lights and the lights in the wheelhouse were extinguished. Cape Town was ablaze with lights. The mountain was floodlit, a great, ghostly, silver hulk under the stars, while behind them the lights on Robben Island twinkled low on the Black Sea. Raleigh judged that they were about halfway between the city and the island. The skipper was waiting for him on deck. "We must move fast now," he said. Robert and Changi climbed into the Zodiac. Their wetsuits were black, the rubber sides of the boat were black, and the engine cover of the Evinrude was black. They would be almost invisible on the black waters. "Thank you, comrade," Raleigh said, and offered the skipper his hand. "Amandla," said the skipper as he gripped it. "Power!" And Raleigh took his place in the bows of the Zodiac. The winch clattered, and the Zodiac rose swaying, swung out over the side, and then fell swiftly to the surface of the water. "Start up," Raleigh instructed, and Robert whipped the starter cord, and the engine fired and caught on the first pull. "Cast off," Raleigh ordered, and Changi unhooked the line from the boom while Robert manoeuvred the Zodiac alongside the trawler and tied onto the light line from the rail. He let the engine idle for 5 minutes to warm it thoroughly, and then cut it. The two vessels lay silently linked together, and the minutes passed torturously. Suddenly the skipper called down, "I have them in sight! Are you certain?" Raleigh cupped his hands around his mouth to reply. "I've seen that ferry every day of my life." The skipper was leaning over the rail. "Start your motor and cast off." The Evinrude roared into life, and the Zodiac dropped back astern of the trawler. Now Raleigh could make out the ferry. It was coming almost directly towards them. Both the green and red navigational lights showed. The trawler moved forward, a wash of white water churning out from under her stern. She was still completely blacked out, and her speed built up rapidly. The skipper had assured Rally that she was capable of 14 knots. She turned in a wide arc across the black surface and headed straight for the approaching ferry at speed. Robert ran the Zodiac out to one side and dropped back slightly, sheering off 200 feet from the larger vessel. The ferry held its course. Clearly it hadn't spotted the darkened ship bearing down out of the night. Rally stood up in the bows of the Zodiac, steadying himself with two turns of the painter around his wrist, and he watched the two vessels come together. The ferry was half the length of the steel-hulled trawler, and it lay much lower in the water. At the very last moment, somebody on board the ferry shouted, and then the bows of the trawler crashed into her, taking her just forward of the beam. Rally had warned the skipper not to damage the cabin and risk harming the occupants. The trawler checked, and the bows rose high as she trod the smaller vessel down, and then the ferry rolled over in a flurry of foam and breaking water. The trawler drove over her, broke free of her swamped hull, and went dashing away into the darkness. Within 100 yards she had disappeared. "The chains will pull him under," Rally shouted. "Work quickly." He fitted his faceplate over his mouth and nose. Robert sent the Zodiac roaring alongside the sinking ferry. She had turned turtle, and her bottom was painted with orange anti-fouling. Her lights were still burning beneath the water, and there were 3 or 4 swimming warders thrashing around, trying to get a grip on the sides. Rally and Changi, each carrying a short jemmy bar, slid over the side and dived under the trawler's submerged transom. Rally jammed the point of the jemmy into the lock of the cabin door, and with a single heave tore it away. The door slid back, and a burst of trapped air exploded in silver bubbles around his head. The cabin was flooded, but the lights were still burning, lighting the interior like a goldfish bowl, and a confusion of bodies clad in the serge uniform of the prison service were struggling and kicking and swirling around the cabin. Amongst them, Rally picked out the khaki cotton drill tunic of a prisoner. He seized a handful of it and pulled Moses Gama clear. Changi took Moses Gama's other arm and they swam with him between them out from under the heaving transom and up to the surface. It had taken less than 60 seconds since the trawler had rammed, and Robert gunned the Zodiac up to them the moment they surfaced. He reached down and caught hold of Moses Gama's arm. The two men in the water heaved from under him, and he rolled over the side of the Zodiac onto the floorboards.